I'm Paul Menzel from PLU, and this session's entitled Smoking, What May the State Do to Discourage It? I almost titled it, What May the State Do to Stop It? But I thought, since that's not really what happens when the state tries to to stop it, discourage would be the better term. I want to do something fairly broad today with a number of highly specific interludes, one might say. The Victorian view, which in a sense has dominated our view of many of these sorts of what we might call private behaviors or private vices, is that smoking is a private vice. The philosophical spokesperson of the principle here is John Stuart Mill, as you may know, who said the only principle, the only basis on which any society can interfere in an individual's behavior is that that individual's behavior affects the not just the welfare, but the sufficiently discernible welfare and great welfare, especially the rights of others in the society. Many problems in stating that principle precisely, but the gist of it is that if you get something that the society regards as genuinely a private vice, then hands off in terms of social regulation. You can morally condemn it, do anything you want, but you cannot use the coercion of the state to even discourage the behavior. And Mill was, he's got a touchy borderline to draw there as to whether taxing it would be legitimate or not. And he himself sort of wobbles on it. But at any rate, that's what we might call the Victorian view of smoking in particular. Now, the contemporary reversal of that view is simply, in a sense, entirely consistent with the principle that John Stuart Mill, the philosopher in particular, held. But just sees the facts quite differently. One should note that one of the things Mill said about the application of the principle that social interference was justified only when an individual's behavior affected others was that the basic reason for that, although it's ultimately utilitarian, is intermediately the autonomy and liberty of the individual. Mill happens philosophically to be a utilitarian, so he's going to justify even the value of autonomy in terms of some kind of general welfare. But this intermediate value of autonomy is very important to Mill. And then he drew one notable exception, which he didn't regard as a genuine exception, but it's an exception to the way the principles sound. That, for example, a person would not be, should not be allowed by the state to sell herself into slavery, because that would be giving up the very autonomy that one was trying to preserve by the principle. Now, if you note that exception to the Victorian view, then it is simply some changes in our perception of the facts about smoking, which lead to quite a different view of what the state may do about smoking in our day and age. First of all, we see that smoking is harmful to others, which was not the view 100 years ago. We see it as addictive, so that if, in fact, we stop a person, even if we may go beyond merely controlling the negative impacts that a smoker has on others, we may actually stop, perhaps, the behavior, discourage the behavior of the smoker because of its harm to herself, because that behavior is not a freely chosen behavior once the addiction forms. Now, this obviously leaves one big problem. What about the free acquisition of the addictive habit? Is it justified to interfere with the free acquisition of the addictive habit? And here, a number of commentators note that people acquiring the smoking habit, it is claimed, don't really know the risks. The risks may be stated on the cigarette packet, and not just in very weak terms like smoking may be harmful to your health, but smoking is harmful to your health. But the author of the book that's in the bookstore, and it's a very nice comprehensive discussion of a lot of things, very definite viewpoints, but an interesting one, is Robert Gooden, titled No Smoking. It's one of the few books just about the social policies about smoking in our society. There are not many of them. And I think one of the most accessible that I've seen. Gooden says that contrasted with the warnings about dangerous uses of lawnmowers, for example, the warning on a cigarette package is not going to be taken to heart by the smoker, because it's very general. It says smoking is harmful and doesn't tell you what will be done that will lead to the harm. You know, the specific kinds of use of smoking will lead to specific kinds of harm. With the lawnmower, you're told specific things that you must not do with the lawnmower, and that grabs the psychological imagination a lot more than when you just tell a person that the whole general package of activity is going to be harmful. Secondly, you don't know when the harm is going to occur, and then thirdly, there's this anchoring fallacy, so-called, that if I have some experience of smoking without deleterious health effects, then I get the conviction that I'm going to be the exception, the person who won't be hit. For a variety of reasons, then, people don't really know, as Gooden puts it, the risks of smoking. Now, this is, I think, highly debatable. One could argue they do know the risks, they just don't act on them and, in a sense, take them to heart. But this is perhaps the most debatable claim on the whole list. Fourthly, there are a number of people, Gooden included, who say that it's a combination of great harm to oneself plus the difficulty of later changing the addictive behavior. Addiction just means greatly, very difficult. It doesn't mean you couldn't change it. It means it's very difficult to change it. That the combination of great harm to the self plus the great difficulty of changing the behavior means that it is legitimate to interfere with a person in even freely acquiring the behavior. It sounds paternalistic, but it's not, according to this argument, because once the person got into that behavior, it would be as irreversible as contracting oneself into slavery, virtually. Not quite, but virtually. And therefore, though the state may not, perhaps, should not, use the full arm of the state's law in stopping a person from smoking, it can use considerable discouragements without being charged with illegitimately, paternalistically interfering with a person's freedom, because the later freedom isn't there. And if one knows that in advance, one may stop the free choice into that later absence of freedom, assuming there's also the presence of great harm to the self. Finally, it's noted that the acquisition of the addictive habit largely happens in an age prior to the age of consent, in teenage years. Now, this isn't always true, but if you look at statistics, it's predominantly true. Most smokers become smokers before 21. We argue, of course, about when the age of consent is, and there are legitimate disputes about where to draw the line, but the claim is then made that society can interfere with smoking behavior both to stop harms to others and to prevent harm to the smoker without violating the essential principle that John Stuart Mill articulated to protect the individual freedom, except when that freedom would be used to either destroy one's own freedom or to harm other people. Now, what do we think about this whole litany of what we might call the basis of the contemporary reversal of our view on the previously thought to be private vice of smoking and the illegitimacy of state interference? Well, first of all, on harm to others. On the health question, I won't dispute that at all. It is harmful. Passive smoking is harmful to others. The degree to which that's true is open for dispute, but I'll just assume that it's not my expert. I know very little about that, so I'll just pass that over. But on some of the other effects on others, I think there are some misconceptions, and I've mentioned this in the previous talk, but I'll... Gordon, could you flip that light switch off the second switch, furthest one from you? This is usually thought to be the economic cost of smoking. Rice, a major author in this field in 86, said the 1984 cost of smoking were $53.7 billion. That's a lot. It is, at the time, in 1986, it was like 14% of healthcare costs. Total economic costs amounted to 14% of the whole healthcare budget. Not all of those costs are healthcare costs. Some are direct healthcare costs, some are lost work time, and some are lost earning years. But as a number of people have noted since, and as I implied in 2 days ago, excuse me, annual cost, yes. Here are two forgotten factors, what you might call benefits of smoking or costs of quitting. Benefits of smoking, putting it that way, pension benefits not paid when the person smoker dies early, who would have otherwise lived longer. Now, health expenses not incurred in later unrelated illnesses the person would have had if they hadn't smoked and lived long. Definite philosophical disputes about whether the first is a real cost, but if we assume that these are real costs, then, and some people are now seeing that they are, some economists now are, we then get the following kind of studies. This one, the initial study which sparked people's thought, captured people's attention, and this was a Swiss study. In 83, for males age 35 by type and smoking status, in terms of Swiss francs, the lifetime, not the year after when they're smoking, but the lifetime, not in a single year, but the lifetime, total medical care expenditure for the average male is 69,700 Swiss francs, the non-smoker 72,700, the smoker 67,900, and then there's this intermediate non-smoking smoker type for psychological predisposition reasons it was put in. At any rate, note that the smoker is the least expensive and the non-smoker is the most expensive of those four categories. And to my knowledge, nobody has disputed this since. There have been a lot of accusations that Loy and Schaub's study was an incomplete study. But when the study's done another way, it doesn't come out with any different conclusion. This is one study that, again, has been challenged for the way it was done, but I haven't seen any claim at all that the conclusion should be different. There's a puzzling discrepancy in these figures, which I can't quite figure out from the author. But at any rate, if you look at the effect on the U.S. Medicare Hospital Insurance Fund, the net effects of 100,000 smokers quitting at age 45 in the 10th year is an aggregate saving of of smokers quitting is an aggregate saving of $991,000 in the 10th year. But by the 20th year, it's a deficit of $5 million. And by the 40th year, it's $12 million deficit. This is if 100,000 smokers quit. The effect on the Medicare fund would save the Medicare fund or cost the Medicare fund. It would cost it $12 million 40 years out. In the 40th year. The aggregate cost, 95, and then, I'm not sure what's going on in her calculations here. I think it has something to do with discounting. The per quitter cost is, the per quitter cost to the U.S. Medicare Hospital Insurance Fund of a person who quits at 45 is $1,495. So smokers don't cost the society medical expenses. They save us. According to these figures, they save us. Now, they may cost us in other ways, however, which may cancel that out. Whoops, this one didn't quite go on. If you look in particular, in terms of the mill principle, at, let's look at the zero discount rate here first. This is the Manning study in JAMA in 1989 in the RAND Corporation. External costs of smoking, trying to glean those out and distinguish them from the other costs, and also note negative external costs, that is savings. You get these various categories of costs of smoking, and then you get savings. A major one is nursing home care, because people don't live long, and the major one is retirement pension. And so you get the net external cost to others, the external costs are cost to others, per pack of cigarettes smoked, 91 cent saving, the negative cost of savings. Now you discount this because some of these benefits and costs are into the future and you get 15 cents as the cost, not the saving. It becomes a cost because the retirement pension saving and the nursing home saving are way out in the future and you discount them back to current rate. I'm not sure it's quite right to discount all that back that much, but at any rate, you do.
5% is very conservative.
There's another whole debate going on about what sorts of things even a 5% rate of discount is appropriate for. It depends on whether we're looking at these as a kind of investment good or not. been sparked by a philosophical treatise by Derek Parfit about 10 years ago. At any rate, suppose we do discount back at 5, this is real rate of discount, not inflation. It's not an inflation factor discount, it's a real time discount, as economists say. That is, a good in the future is really less of a good to me than a good now. Total net external costs are, in fact, 15 cents. It's not a saving, but Van Manning claims that even if you add, under more conservative assumptions, 23 other cents of extra costs from altered assumptions, namely counting fires and passive smoking as external costs. Not clear their external costs or what degree, proportion of them are external costs. That is, cost to others, not cost to the smoker. We get 38 cents as the net external cost, and then noting that the current tobacco tax per pack average in the United States is 37 cents, he recommends that we not increase cigarette tax. No, this is Rand Corporation. No, the cigarette companies don't fund anything like this. They're afraid to even mention this data, because though it would help them oppose tax increases, it's admitting that smokers die early, and they're not about to do that. They have just written out of all their literature any mention of this stuff. This is independent academics. Anyway, so in terms of effects on others, we have to be careful. Probably not any negative economic effects, but there is clearly a health effect in terms of passive smoking. On addiction, what should we say? Well, clearly one could say smoking is not an addiction if one defined an addiction as a condition which one had no control of and could not stop. Smokers obviously do stop. One must carefully define an addiction as one in which it is just more difficult to stop. Now, there's one notion of addiction here, which is quite interesting, that some economists have for it, and in fact, quite a few people have, other than those particular economists have adopted, but they still run the argument which eventually comes out in favor of interference with the smoker's behavior. It's the notion of a rational addiction. It's that once you are addicted, it is rational not to change, because what happens in the addiction is simply your desires for the good and the pain of withdrawal are such that it makes it irrational to change the behavior. Now, at first, this looks like an argument that you should allow smokers, since they are now rationally addicted and are rational in choosing not to get out of their addiction, it looks like an argument for not interfering with the smoker's behavior. But in fact, it doesn't amount to that kind of argument at all. Because even though you have a rational addiction defined that way, that is, once you are addicted, it's rational not to change, you might at the same time strongly wish that you had never acquired the desires that now make it rational for you not to change. And if you have what we might call a second-order desire, a desire that you not ever have acquired the desires that now make it rational for you not to have changed, what's wrong with adding some extra impetus, like high taxes or whatever, to allow you to change, to now make it more rational for you to change, well, really less irrational for you to change. So that...
On your definition of addiction, with your first addiction, for your first definition, do you think anything that's that way?
That's a rational addiction?
So anything that you can't stop.
No, I don't think the first definition of addiction is a workable definition at all.
For anything.
And so I think the only plausible definition of addiction that there is that it's a behavior which it is unreasonably costly to stop, which is precisely the definition that of rational addiction. It's the notion of rational addiction. Rational in a certain limited sense. Once you've got the addiction, it's rational not to stop. But if in fact, as Gooden argues, it is still the case that the person wishes they, is a big if the person wishes that they would not have acquired these desires that now make it rational for them to stay with the habit, then it would seem like there's a higher order of consent or will or volition, which would actually line up with interfering with the individual's rational continuance of with the behavior. This gets to be very tricky at this point, and one might argue that it isn't at all clear that just because smokers say they wish they hadn't acquired the habit, that they really do have the desire that they never have acquired the habit. There may be all sorts of face-saving, both to themselves and to other people. How do we know that the desire that they never acquired, that they have never acquired, that would have acquired the habit, is sufficiently great to justify interference with what is now presently existing as a rational addiction?
When you have this rational addiction, it seems like that's something that they're weighing, you know, all the time. And isn't it very likely that, say, if you've taxed it to $3 a pack, that then many people are going to weigh it out differently and say it was rational when it was $1 a pack, but it's not rational now. I need to stop. Now I want to stop.
If in fact, we'll get to the taxation question. Like if the economic demand for cigarettes were that elastic, that is, dropped, was really affected by higher prices for an addict, then yes, we could perhaps justify higher cigarette taxes with that kind of reason. But let's go on. I'll get to the particular policy questions, some particular policy questions later. What about the second? We've dealt with the second addiction. What about the third? Knowledge of the risks. One might say, simply in response to the claim that the warnings are too general, that there's this anchoring fallacy, people think themselves, that they haven't yet gotten an illness that will escape it in the future. And also the claim that there's a lot of deceptive advertising, hidden health messages and health images amidst this advertising for cigarettes. The Marlboro man is extremely healthy looking. That in fact, these are no reason at all for interfering in a person's behavior. The people still freely, in effect, choose not to imagine the risks concretely enough. They choose to be taken in by the deceptive advertising. They choose to be taken by the anchoring fallacy, et cetera. Well, even if they don't explicitly consciously choose, it's their responsibility would be the point. Don't have to argue that they consciously choose that. It's just their responsibility and not the state's responsibility to prevent them from exercising their responsibility about that very matter of their awareness or their taking these issues to heart. So I think this is probably the most debatable one of, besides the economic harm to others, which I think sort of falls by the wayside, not the health harm to others. This third item is probably the weakest of the claims in the anti-smoking case. The fourth claim, that there's that if there's a great difficulty in changing and great stakes to the person harming herself, that then interference is justified, could be challenged in the following way. We might say, well, the difficulty of changing is not peculiar to smoking at all. There are oodles of things in life that are very difficult for people to change once they get in them, but we don't call them addiction. If we were really just to take that notion, not absence of control, but the rational addiction notion, it's unreasonably costly to change, that definition of addiction. If we took that as a definition of addiction, we'd find out that lots of things are addiction. And yet we don't justify interfering, the state's interference with those things. There is, I think, one response here that might be made, which is that smoking's different because its harmfulness is so universally demonstrated. I may be addicted to the professorial life. It may be more difficult for me to get out of the life of a professor than it is for a smoker to quit smoking. But you can't demonstrate as easily the harmfulness to the society or to me of that way of life as you can demonstrate the harmfulness of smoking both to the society and to the smoker. Now the problem with that, of course, is the smoker might say, oh, it looks harmful to you, but to me, the satisfactions of smoking are sufficiently great to outweigh in value the risk to my health. And if that's remotely plausible, or if it's really plausible, not just perhaps remotely, then the case for state interference would be in turn severely jeopardized. Because we do believe that those weighings of value about different kinds of life, including the length of life vis-a-vis certain qualities of life, should be left up, generally we say that should be left up to the individual. All kinds of precedents for that in the rest of our social policy. So why should we opt out of that room we give people to make those trade-offs within their life when we get the smokers? It would just reveal a social prejudice against smokers, not a consistent social policy throughout our communal life. That argument in turn, that defense of the freedom of smokers to smoke without state interference would be defeated, of course, if the person said that she'd wish she'd not acquired the habit. If smokers themselves, by and large, say they wish they had not acquired the habit, that's saying that though it's now reasonable for them to stay smokers, the gains in being smokers are, they can see, not worth the risks, though now once they're in them, it's irrational to get out. And if smokers themselves say that, then it seems to me, in turn, that it might, we might be justified as a society in quasi-coercively, at least, interfering with their behavior.
Why do you think there is a social prejudice against smokers now, and there hasn't been in years past, 10 or 20 years ago? Why not?
Well, maybe it's just not a social prejudice, but a social, a legitimate social judgment about them, but I know I was labeling it a prejudice only if it was inconsistent with our other views. If we say in general it's up to the individual to weigh whether certain things that society thinks are bad really are bad enough to cancel out certain things that the individual thinks are good.
But why do you think people are focusing more on this now than they have 15 years ago?
Well, one thing is passive smoking and harms to others, but that's essentially a different issue and raises essentially different policy recommendations. Should give rise to different policy recommendations than the questions of interfering in the behavior of a smoker herself for her own sake.
Is there a shifting in the numbers of people who are smokers and non-smokers?
Oh yes, it's dropped off. It's gone up, the rate's gone up for teenage women and gone down for every other category.
So that could be a fact that there's more and more people are antagonistic to smoking.
Just because there are fewer people are smoking.
Smaller and smaller majority, and people. Because it's less socially acceptable. I want to know why. Why is it so acceptable 20 and 30 years ago and not now?
But it's only about then that it became clear that it was a medical health. Before that, doctors were saying it was healthy, you know. And so, well, my mother always knew better. I always thought that was just her prejudice. Mm-hmm. Why I started.
Yeah, I think it's that fact primarily. Then there's also the evidence about the harm of passive smoking. And thirdly, I think there's a shift in attitude about what nuisances we tolerate. Mm-hmm. Americans are less prone to tolerate nuisances now than they were 50 years ago. It seems to me. I don't know. I didn't live 50 years ago. Quite. So. I don't know. Is that remotely plausible or not? But I would guess it is. And so we're more prone to say now that your rights stop at the end of my nose.
This may be kind of far out, but I think also 30 years ago, men smoked, women didn't, and women then less than now weren't very assertive. And so they were just going to suffer in silence, and huge numbers of men were smoking.
Okay, so I think there are some problems with this view, but ultimately perhaps it could be sustained. The clearest piece of evidence you'd need to sustain interference with the smoker herself, not just to prevent the smoker from harming others, on the basis of this argument would be if smokers by and large say they wish they hadn't acquired the habit. If a good many of them, however, claim that though there are and the liberty of the individual here would be on thin ice indeed. All I'm trying to point out here is that I think we need to do some fairly complicated, consistent social philosophizing in a general sense, not an academic sense, in trying to make policies toward smokers consistent with policies toward other things in our society, or we will be discriminatory against smokers. Now, in terms of actual policies, what may we clearly, I think, quite justifiably do, and what's debatable? May we ban advertising? Well, it said it's deceptive. Well, there's lots of deceptive advertising. I'm not sure why we should ban cigarette advertising just because it's deceptive. Unless you could point out that we do ban deceptive advertising whenever the behavior poses great risk of harm to the self, to oneself, and creates a behavior which is very difficult to change, the combination of those two things. And we were to consistently carry that out. And if in fact we, that's right, we would have to ban deceptive advertising for that as well as deceptive advertising for smoking. It is further claimed, and this is, I think, a quite salient point, that we perhaps should be forced to ban all advertising because you can't allow any advertising virtually without that advertising affecting teenagers. And if you view them as really not having their autonomy yet, the morally relevant kind of autonomy, then you should, it's not just up that it's okay to interfere, it's that you almost have an obligation to interfere, because what's happening to them when they are led into smoking is that they're led into a situation that both harms them and that they can't change reasonably easily. So we have an obligation to defend them by, for example, banning advertising.
Washington State has a legal age to purchase cigarettes.
Yes, I think it's 18.
Yeah. So.
But why isn't it 21?
Well, but why? I think most teenagers who start smoking probably start before they're 18.
Yeah.
And so, if we look at it from a legal standpoint, people who are selling cigarettes to children who are under 18.
Sure. And there are real problems in banning sales to teenagers because they can get them through other people as long as there's going to be a black market. Yeah, right. But we do, the study seemed to show that having a 21 age limit on drinking really does cut down on drinking under age 21. Not doesn't eliminate it, but it cuts it in half at least. Why wouldn't raising the minimum age for cigarette purchase to 21 do the same thing, if we also had some minimal enforcement?
But I think it has to do with enforcement, that's the thing.
Of the stores that sold the cigarettes.
There's enforcement for people who sell beer to people under the age of 21. There's virtually no enforcement.
Why is it any more difficult to enforce that for cigarettes?
I'm not sure that it is. I think it's just a matter of social acceptance.
Right.
Well, I think they're trying to do away with selling cigarettes through vending machines now. They have not
yes,
done that.
Yes, that would be another first step that I think should be taken. I think the more interesting argument here is that you should ban all advertising, even to adult smokers, because that advertising will be viewed by teenagers. And though adults shouldn't be interfered with in perhaps in their liberty to adopt a damaging habit, because though it's addictive, it's no more addictive than a lot of other things in life, you should interfere with measures that entice people of unconsenting age, below the age of consent.
Advertising, but it seems like you were saying that banning the advertising would be unfair to smokers. I can't imagine. I can't imagine many smokers complaining at all. That would be simply being unfair to the tobacco industry.
Yes. That's right. I think, in fact, that if you really try to push all the possible objections to a ban on advertising, they don't amount to much. And that
free speech, I think, is a big objection.
But, wait a minute. This is speech that entices people below the age of consent into a greatly damaging and difficult to change behavior. Why is that speech that's significant to protect.
Oh, I think almost all speech is significant to protect. I don't want the state telling me what, should I be arrested if I suggest to a kid that he should smoke a cigarette, that it's really a pleasure? I don't think so at all.
If Socrates is corrupting the youth, the state could stop.
I'm a school teacher, and I would expect parents to get on me, real bad if I started advertising, promoting books in my class. But as a person, I don't think that should be banned at all, just because, talk about a slippery slope. I think you say I can't talk to a kid about smoking, then what else can I talk about?
Well. Is it a slippery? I mean, do you have demonstrated harm in the other sorts of cases that you might slide into? I doubt it. So there you get a block on the slide.
No, there's lots of things.
Demonstrated harm?
Well, sure.
What should I be free to talk to teenagers about that demonstratively harms them?
I think you should be free to talk to teenagers about anything. And you can demonstrate harm, seatbelts, the helmet, certain forms of sex, sexual behavior. Gods and things in life are dangerous. All sorts of consumer goods.
So that's potentially dangerous. Not always.
Smoking isn't always dangerous to every kid. Absolutely not.
That's probably less than half.
What do you mean by demonstrated harm?
Well, demonstrably harmful to the group, and harmful even in terms of the values of the victim, not just the values of other people in society. Now, this, of course, would not be the case if smokers themselves said the subjective satisfactions of smoking outweighed the health risks. But assuming that's not the case, smokers generally say they wish they hadn't acquired the habit.
Well, it's absolutely true that smoking is a damaging activity generally. It's not absolutely true that it's damaging individually.
Well, it doesn't kill every smoker, but the risk is universal to all smokers.
Well,
it's not the case that 50% of the smokers are genetically or physiologically made up in a certain way that they're immune to the health risks
of
smoking.
I'm not wearing a helmet. Should we say it's illegal for someone to say you could go ahead and ride that without a helmet?
For people under 21? For motorcyclists under 21, you bet.
Not, but he's asking if you can say it.
Oh, say it. Well, maybe I can say it. Again, there's a difference between advertising it, quote, publicly, and saying it individually. But we have to be very, maybe there isn't a difference, but at least that's a possible line we might draw. I'm not sure what the right line here is, but I think there are a number of plausible cases to be made for different, there are plausible cases to be made for a number of different lines, and what we should do is think out consistently the smoking case vis-a-vis other sorts of behavior. So I'm very much encouraging of the kind of thinking you're doing. You're comparing with other behaviors and what it would be legitimate to what speech it would be legitimate to interfere with and what you wouldn't. And if in fact you get the right parallels working, then maybe the case for banning cigarette advertising falls on its face. I'm not sure it does. I suspect you can draw the right lines to maintain your consistency.
There is a legal distinction between traditional free speech and commercial free speech, and that's what we're looking at here.
Yeah, but
that's not to say it's a legitimate line. But that's the line.
But there's not much of a line there, I don't think, between commercial speech and free speech. I think that it's very, very fuzzy. If you ban advertising altogether, would that also ban, writing? Could people not write articles suggesting cigarettes? Or could they do it if they didn't name brand? I think it's real complicated
That's the nature of law. It's complicated.
Yes, but we don't have very many laws that limit free speech. And that whatever we do, I think we want to look very, very careful.
Speaking to an individual or writing an article in an academic journal, one might argue, is different, essentially, than advertising publicly. But I mean, it's not easy to draw that distinction. One would have to do the hard work of making that distinction stick. So the case for banning advertising isn't a tremendously easy case to make by any means. I think it's a case where it's plausible to try to make it, and I would suspect one could probably make it in the end. But the society certainly shouldn't ban all cigarette advertising without thinking the matter through carefully, I would think. What about other measures? Well, we already talked about banning the public availability of cigarettes and to teenagers. That, I think, makes a lot of sense if we're already banning alcohol. Unless you were to argue that the autonomy of a teenager is as valuable as the autonomy of a 21-year-old. That gets us into another whole discussion. But,
another equally plausible argument is that the autonomy of the family unit and the autonomy of the individuals within the family unit should not be usurped by the notion of having society as a whole interposing its values within that family.
So if mom and dad want to raise the kids in the smoking behavior, that's fine.
Well, perhaps. the question is, should society be attempting to interpose itself in that?
Well, if in fact, in that particular case, presumably the parents would give the cigarettes to the kids, and of course you could also take the further step of making it illegal for a private individual to even give, much less sell, cigarettes to a minor. But I mean, there are all sorts of grades in the prohibition, all of which I think should be thought out very carefully in terms of the consistency.
But you made this point too on society about cigarettes being a gateway drug, and that statistically, youth that start using the first drug they use, or the first thing they use, is cigarettes. Almost universally, when you ask kids who've been in treatment or are in treatment, what was the first thing you did? It was smoke a cigarette.
Also, the most murderous one they ever take is probably a cigarette, too. I mean, gateway to a lot of things you've already.
More than alcohol, you think?
Oh, yeah.
That's a lot more death.
Terms of death. Maybe not in terms of disruption of the rest of their lives, but in terms of death. Well, at any rate, we also need to consider the effect on others here and the ban of smoking in what sorts of places. Well, the easiest case to make is obviously where people are both trapped in an environment for long enough periods of time to, or in an environment, not trapped, in an environment for long enough periods of time to make the passive smoking damage very significant. And it takes a combination of that factor plus the unavailability of reasonable alternatives to being in that environment. Now, generally, we take jobs to be that. It's not easy to get another job. So we tend to take the workplace as a case where we could ban smoking. John has already pointed out that, well, what if smokers decided to form their own company and allow smoking? should that company be exempt from the law that says the workplaces must be free of smoke? I think a legitimate case could be made for that, but in turn, John's noted there wouldn't be a market, or was it Vern that noted there wouldn't be a market for that? sort of thing.
No,
discussion we had otherwise. That there wouldn't be any many companies that would be willing to forego the advantages of employing non-smokers and put out their shingle only to smoking employees.
They forego their whole pension plan.
Insurance.
Hey, that's right. They'd have cheaper pension plans.
Great.
Maybe there is a terrific market in this. Not in the Northwest. There aren't enough smokers in the Northwest. Smokers only need apply. I think a more interesting case is the ones where we get not the health harm, but the nuisance harm, so to speak, where it's the offensiveness to taste, that crossing of the nose barrier rather than breathing into the lungs. And in turn, where the setting is not one which it is, where there are no, to which there are no reasonable alternatives, reasonably uncostly alternatives, not unreasonably costly alternatives. And one example that comes to mind is the English pub. should the state ban smoking? If you put yourself in the culture of England, they could also take the American pub, but take the English pub first. There are a lot of smokers who like to hang out in English pubs. There are alternatives to social life in England than English pubs, but you know, so much of the social life revolves around the pub in England. But ironically, it's precisely in England, not in the U.S., where I think you get a stronger case for banning smoking in the pub, because it's a social avenue which there's not an easy, as easy and equal alternative to. And yet the English, of course, are the least likely to ban smoking in taverns, much less likely than Americans are. Should the American state ban smoking in American taverns? I think that's a real touchy one. And I can't formulate it really convincing argument on either side of that one. Another proposal is to medicalize the sale of tobacco, to say it's a drug, and therefore under the FDA, and if it's harmful, it can be prescribed only under carefully restricted conditions by physicians who would presumably say whether you were or were not an addict. There are problems in this, namely determining who is and who isn't an addict, unless you wanted to say that it was, well, this would be a half-hearted measure. It should be sold in pharmacies only, but over-the-counter, and not by prescription. Or it could be sold by prescription, but there would be no stipulation that prescriptions be limited to those who were addicts. But those would be strange kinds of arrangements, which would have little plausibility. The one that has some plausibility, restricting it only to people who are addicts, raises the other problem of how to determine who's an addict or not. And who's going to, and certainly somebody's going to make a lot of money determining who's an addict and who isn't.
The black market is also going to make a lot of money once you try to do that, too.
Yeah. Now, taxes, I think, are the most interesting one. It's been noted by the empirical students of this, that the economic demand for cigarettes is quite elastic for teenagers, or moderately elastic for teenagers. That is, when you double the price, the demand drops, say roughly in half. If you double the price of a cigarette to an addicted adult, or an addicted teenager, generally assuming that it's the adults that are by and large addicted here, not teenagers, the demand doesn't drop 50%. It drops only 20% or 10%. It's a relatively inelastic demand, which is exactly what you'd expect from any addictive behavior. In fact, one might simply define an addictive behavior as a behavior with the use of a good for which there is inelastic demand. At any rate, if that's the case, then you've got a real problem with justifying the taxation of cigarettes for adults, taxation above and beyond what's necessary to recoup the costs they impose on others. That's justified by other principles. But further taxation to discourage them harming themselves is difficult to justify, since if they're addicted, though to be sure we aren't interfering with their freedom, we're perhaps helping them be free by discouraging them from smoking, their demand is inelastic, and we're in effect exploiting a person who can't get out of the habit of buying the cigarettes. We're using them as a tax revenue source. So it's precisely addiction which allows the state to get out of the charge that it's interfering with a person's freedom if it has high taxes above and beyond what's necessary to recoup external costs. But at the same time, addiction guts the claim that it's fair to do that, because you're exploiting a person who can't help but buy the cigarette, or virtually can't help but buy it.
I think one criticism that can be made of that argument is the notion that in collecting all of the economic costs, completely ignored has been the cost to all the individuals who hate the smell of smoke. For example, I'm sitting in my room up here, and I smell smoke outside my window from a cigarette. I mean, you've got to pay me a lot of money to reimburse me for that, and I'm never going to get it.
You're not talking about the health effects.
No.
You're just talking about the nuisance.
Simple aggravation of having the clean, fresh air spoiled by a cigarette. So that's an economic cost that's obviously impossible to quantify and clearly impossible to reimburse.
You don't need taxes. The tax proposal is irrelevant to that. You do that with bans on smoking in public places.
But smoking out, it's difficult how wide the ban is going to be.
It would mean you can't smoke if the smoke's going to drift out into a hallway of an apartment, because the hallway is essentially public. It's other effect. Public doesn't mean publicly owned, it means other effect.
Yeah. But as a practical matter, that's not going to happen. Either ban.
Why not?
But I think it creates a justification for a much higher level of taxation than already exists.
The PLU, the rule is you can only smoke in your faculty office. Can't smoke in the classrooms, can't smoke in the hallways, can't smoke in any administrative offices because other people are often there. Crazy assumption that students are less likely to be in faculty offices than other people are likely to be in administrative offices, but it's probably...
Yeah, you wouldn't smoke isn't just out there. That's right.
But assuming that the faculty offices are really the kinds of things where very few other people are. If it drips out the window, it's not likely to harm anybody other than being an extreme... No, not even harm. It's such a minor nuisance. John Stuart Mill would say that's the kind of nuisance people can easily turn their head to. People choose, are in effect responsible for their own feeling of being offended and irritated by certain sorts of things. And it's within our capacity to be not so irritated by that minor level.
Except for the ones who are highly allergic to it.
Yes, true. You get that problem.
Aren't there things in this society that are totally offensive that you have no control of? In this case, we're looking at something that, for some reason, we feel now that we can have some control of. I go back to when people smoke. The male, I think of the drawing room after dinner. The men went off with their big cigars and left the women in the drawing room. There's a whole history. I think of the Bush and the Colorado. The cultural aspect of it. The fact is that if you look in recent history, things are changing for people smoking and non-smokers dramatically. How long have people smoked cigarettes with paper on? I don't know. 1890. When did women start? Who was the author who wrote about the 1920s when women started smoking? That incredible thing that happened culturally where women became really cool to smoke. It was dangerous to do it as a woman, but then it was part of that invention. Well, how many years are we talking about in terms of the thing? It's gone through a cultural swing. Now it's going through perhaps another cultural swing. And now I'm hearing some kind of a legislative answer to something that through maybe education might in 20 years just be non-existent in society just because people understand. They use their intellect, their minds, they learn. And here we try to legislate. So haven't we tried to legislate in the past? When we talk about beer, and 21, we live on Whidbey Island out here, I watch all the time kids getting beer from people in that community who shouldn't be selling it to them. They just, to legislate things is, in this case...
It could be. I titled the session, What May the State Do to Discourage Smoking? Not what the state.
There's a wonderful page in Mad Magazine last month about smokers and what they have to do now to smoke. And it is the funniest thing you ever saw. People out in elevator shafts without an elevator and, three with coats on, freezing to death.
Well, that's why I wasn't facetious when I was suggesting that it's appropriate, perhaps, to have companies that say, hey, our policy is we want everybody to work here, but we want everybody coming in to know that you should have the right to smoke when you come in here.
I feel the same way about the Scott Paper Company in Everett or over in Port Townsend when they're blasting out their smoke or the refineries up north when all that smoke is drifting down to me, polluting the air. Why don't we do something? But what are we gonna do here? We're gonna go after this individual right here, almost as like a whipping boy, seems like, if this is the case. I mean, is this in fact what people are considering?
Oh yeah, all these proposals are being considered and
that's incredible when you think about it.
Sullivan is plugging a number of them very hard.
That's my opinion.
It could be that legislation is unwise. It could also be that it's the way to capture the cultural moment and solidify a cultural trend. Very difficult to know which whether it's going to, whether legislation would go the way of prohibition, or whether legislation would sort of solidify the cultural trend against smoking. Done?
Regress to the main study. I'm real skeptical about it. I find myself unconvinced, and there's a couple questions I have about it. One is, if smoking, in fact, reduces the cost to society over time, why is it then that private insurers allow a deduction, a discount?
No, that's because they're not paying the whole cost of healthcare over a lifetime. They're paying only the cost primarily till 65, and then the cost of healthcare to 60, and from when everyone smokes until 65 is definitely lower for non-smokers than for smokers, but it's not lower for lifetime as a whole. Manning also didn't say, Manning, unlike Warner, another major author in this, doesn't conclude that smoking is costless to others. He concludes that it probably does cost on the average 37, 38 cents a pack, and then just simply notes that that's the current cigarette tax and surmises that it leaves hanging. The focus of his article, their article, is not that, is not the taxation policy question per se, but he just drops the thought that maybe this means that we shouldn't raise cigarette tax.
The other thing that comes to mind is that yesterday we decided that society's resources somewhat proportional to the society's population. The population increases,
sure,
you have the capacity to create resources. And these smokers are dying off early, as Manning factored in the opportunity.
Factored
cost.
In. Factored in lost people. Earnings.
Yeah.
Factored in lost earnings already. All that's taken account of already, and still you come out with cost to others of smoking being only what the current cigarette tax is. Not
but you didn't factor in the city. Like, as we talked about yesterday, that all the non-GNP contributions that other people would be making.
Right. Volunteer ones.
Your volunteer and family health and community service kinds of things. But that's not factored into that.
The value of the life itself is lost. As we were trying to put a monetary value not on the economic productivity of the life, but on the life itself. Manning notes that at his chosen rate of a value of life, $1.66 million per 20 years. I think that's fairly high. But that's what he does. He points out that the total cost, not cost to others, but total cost of smoking a pack of cigarettes is $5.38. Namely, $5 for the value of life and 38 cents for the cost to others. And then the question comes up, is part of that value of life, a value of life to others, that we should see as an external cost, not. But that's tricky because so much of the value of life to others is already accounted for by the economics. I mean, if you look at this gets very complicated. But if you just try to price out economically the value of a life to society, it turns out to be roughly in the $500,000 to $700,000 range. If you price out what the value of life is to the person whose life it is in terms of their willingness to spend money to reduce risk to their life, $100 for a safety device that eliminates a certain very small risk, but not more than $100 for that safety device, figures tend to gravitate around $1 million to $1.5 million. If you look at what other people are willing to pay to save a person's life, it seems to be no more than the economic productivity of that person. So should you add anything other than the economic productivity of that person's life when you're trying to capture this component we would call the value of a person's life to others? Well, our intuition is that we should, but Manning might argue that that's already captured indirectly through some of the other economic categories. It would be a tricky argument to make, but it's precisely the kinds of things you see thrown around in the so-called value of life literature in the economic journal.
Does the dollar cost include, like, I have a widow in my congregation whose husband...